that's impressive. Commiserations. One pick up where we finished yesterday. Here's what happened yesterday, at least in my mind, which may or may not match what happened in your mind, but let's see. Yesterday I was talking about what I think are some of the most common ways that Christian school communities try to make a connection between Christian and education. The first one we talked about was bringing the Bible into your classroom, making scriptural texts part of your teaching in some way. And I said, yes, but we've got to think about what they're actually doing pedagogically, not just whether the truth that they express is one that we want to talk about. Secondly, we talked about this model where you've got to develop a Christian mind. You need to think about whether the ideas in your teaching are Christian. Are there truths or falsehoods in your curriculum, in your textbook, and so on. And I said, yes, but again, the ideas in the curriculum are important, but teaching and learning is not just made up of ideas. It's made up of what happens to those ideas once we start interacting around them. And again, we've got to think about pedagogical process, not just content. Third, we talked about virtue. And I said, yes, through the Holy Spirit in you, hopefully you're growing in virtue, that's relevant to your teaching, but it's not just about what's in your heart, because as soon as you step into a classroom, there are pedagogical processes going on where your teaching behaviors are being interpreted by students as related or not related to certain virtues. So all the way along, I was trying to say, we need to think not just about ideas, not just about Bible texts, not just about virtues. Yes, all of those things. You don't tear down the parts of the wall you've got already to fill in the gaps. It's not productive. But we need a better conversation than it seems to me we've often had, unless you're the glowing exception, and you might be. I don't know. We need a better conversation than we've often had about what might be Christian about teaching and learning processes, about the interactions that take place in our classroom. Quick example, quick random example of the kind of thing that I have in mind here. There's an interesting book by Peter McLaren, education scholar. It's called Schooling as a Ritual Performance. It's a pretty dense read. But it describes a lengthy study that he made of a Catholic school in Toronto. And there's one interesting little passage where he describes noticing over time that each teacher that he observed had what he calls a power spot. And what he means by that is there was a particular place in the classroom that this teacher would tend to retreat to when they felt threatened, or when they needed to give instructions, or when they needed in some way to assert their authority. For one of the teachers, it was behind the desk. For another teacher, it was two paces to the left of the desk. It was different places for different teachers, but each teacher, he hypothesized, had a power spot. One day, he was, of course, just a researcher at the back of the classroom. The teacher had to step out for a few minutes and left him in charge. And so he got up and started wandering around the room. And he noticed that as he gradually got closer to this teacher's power spot, the volume of the conversation in the classroom slowly went down. And the moment he stepped into the power spot, one of the students raised her hand and said, "Are you the teacher now?" Suppose you want to pray in class. Does it matter where you stand? What would the implications be of praying out of the power spot? Or not out of the power spot? Would that be different? You might be praying the same words, but it might not be quite doing the same thing, depending on where you're standing. The classrooms are just fascinating, complex things. There's a ton of stuff going on. It's like a rainforest ecology. And we need some better conversations about how some of this other stuff that's not just books and ideas, how that might affect the Christianness or otherwise of what we're doing. Could prayer turn into crowd control? Could you appear to be praying at the front of class, and in fact, you're manipulating, you're imposing order, you're telling students to behave in words that sound like prayer? Does that ever happen? I'm going to pull some ideas in this session from a website that I and some colleagues, including Alison Weldon, who's here somewhere, have been working on for the last couple of years. It's called whatiflearning.co.uk, write the address down, go look at it later. And what we're trying to do on this website, I'll talk a little bit more about it at the end, was to create a resource that looks at what I'm getting at here. What's Christian about your pedagogy? And you find 100 examples here from every area of the curriculum. So I won't be able to cover every area of the curriculum in the next 40 minutes. But the website is the footnote. Right? So if you go there afterwards, you can get examples for math, science, physical education, whatever you like. You can filter them by subject. You can filter them by age range. And one of the things we tried to do in the structure of this site was to say, I always had this impulse first to say to teachers, you know, your classroom is way more complicated than you think it is. There's all this stuff going on about posture and position and tone and volume and furniture and so on. Because I just find that fascinating. There's a certain point at which it becomes unhelpful because you can't pay attention to that many things when you're planning. And you need some way of boiling this down to a set of reference points that you might be able to run through as you prepare for class. So that's what we try to do. So we've got three reference points. We argue in this site that you need to be paying attention to seeing anew, choosing engagement, and reshaping practice. And I'm going to unpack each of those this morning with some positive examples. And I'm going to do so initially in relation to my language class. And this is partly just revenge for all of the Christian education conferences that I went to as a language teacher, where foreign languages was never mentioned. It's partly also because it's something I happen to know something about, and that's helpful. But I also just want to be concrete. Now, the disadvantage of being concrete is if I talk about math, then I'm not talking about science and so on. But one of my frustrations often going to Christian education conferences was hearing the big slogans about Christian education and it never quite trickling down to what you do with 12-year-olds on a Tuesday morning. So that's the level I want to get down to, and that means I need to be concrete and specific. So I said yesterday, I come to the conclusion in teaching that the social structure of my language class was what I call structurally egocentric. If you looked at the things we said to each other, the topics that we talked about, the pictures in our textbooks, the topics in our textbooks, the example sentences in the grammar exercises, many of them began with I, few of them began with you, and a lot of them were about buying consumer goods for myself and filling up my leisure time on the weekend with hedonistic activity. That was the picture that was coming through my that was what as Christian teacher I was teaching. I've got a few options here. As was just said, I can go Christianity light. I can carry on doing what I'm doing. I pray at the weekends. I witness to my unsaved friends. Maybe even run a Bible study in the school at lunchtime. That's called hypocrisy. Or I can look at this and I can throw up my hands in despair. I can say, oh my goodness, this is just terrible. I should go do something easier, like be a missionary or a pastor. Or I can actually do what it took me 4 or 5 years into my teaching career to decide, which is to say, this is what God has called me to do. For better or worse, God has not called me to be Billy Graham, John Wesley, Hudson Taylor, whoever you want to add to the list. In his infinite wisdom, God has called me to be a language teacher, which means I get to spend the years that I have figuring out how to be a Christian language teacher. This is the form of discipleship that I'm going to walk in. It's not the whole of my life, I'm not going to sleep at school. But it's going to be a fair number of the hours in my life. It's going to be a major part of what I do. It's going to be a major part of what I present to the Lord in the end. And this is what I'm going to have to start working on figuring out. It might take me a lifetime, that's okay. But this is what I'm going to need to work on. And the other reason why it's important, and this struck me early in my teaching career, just struck me that every time I walk into a classroom, the children in front of me, or the young adults in front of me now, this is an hour of their life that they will never get back. And I'm the person with the most power over whether this hour gets spent fruitfully or not. I get to waste other people's lives. Or not. Each time I walk into a classroom. So what do I start doing? Well, let's look at seeing anew. What we're trying to get at here is this whole realm of how do you imagine what you're doing? What do you think you're doing when you walk into a classroom? What do you imagine is going on? We've all got ideas of what it is to teach. And they constrict the way that we teach. I remember I taught in a school Once it was known as the boarding school because the windows were all boarded up after each vacation when the kids had smashed them all. It was an urban public school in, do you call state schools public schools here? Which version of English do you do on that? Yeah, it was a state school, urban school. We didn't have most of the foreign language textbooks because the summer before I got there, the kids had filled trash cans with gasoline and combustibles and burned down the foreign language building. So it's just an interesting place. We put all of the 11-year-olds through the London reading test, and 60% of them came out below the special education needs percentile. Am I supposed to teach German? From a textbook that was written for middle-class kids who are going to go to Germany on vacation and buy Coke and burgers and check into hotels. And it was pretty clear from the get-go this wasn't going to work. So one day I come into class, and the topic in the textbook is parts of the body, you know, head and shoulder and elbow and hand and so on. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to teach this to a room full of 11-year-olds with a 30-second attention span and sub-7-year-old reading skills. So I came in. What I decided to do was, first of all, we chanted, sang the words, we shouted them, we did lots of fun things with them just to get used to the sound of the words for 5 or 10 minutes. Then we played Simon Says for a little while. You know, Simon Says, touch your nose, and so on. And then I moved all the chairs and tables into the middle of the room so that we had kind of a runway around the edge. And I got the students in groups of three and gave them all little cards. They got two words on them. The first one said, you know, two parts of the body, so it might say head and elbow. A, B, head and elbow. And the students would stand in the group of three. The first one would have to turn up a card and read out the two words, Kopf, hand, whatever it was. And then they would give the card to the other two students, and the other two students have to suspend this card in the air between those two body parts. Right? So if it's elbow and stomach, then the card goes there. And you turn the next card. The next card's knee and hand. Right? So that one goes there. And the task was, how many cards can you keep in the air at the same time without falling over? The record was 13. Then after we'd done this for 10 minutes, I gave them all a pair of scissors and a stopwatch. I had to steal the stopwatches from the physical education department because they don't give language teachers stopwatches. So with the scissors, they cut the cards in half. Now they've got twice as many cards with one word on them. And now one student had to lie down on the floor, which was great for classroom management because it took a third of them out of circulation. The second one had to hold the stack of cards. And the third one had the stopwatch, and the one with the cards had to label the body on the floor as fast as they could against the clock and use up all the cards. And at this point, I'm standing on the tables in the middle of the room with a clipboard, and they're yelling out their best times from different corners of the classroom, and I'm screaming back, like, 12 seconds over here, can anybody beat 12 seconds? And at this moment, the school principal walks past the open door of the classroom with two parents who are looking around the school as a prospective place to bring their children. You know when you're listening to your music and your parents walk into the room, it suddenly sounds different? It was just one of those moments when I realized how far I'd stepped outside of what was supposed to be my role as a teacher, which was to stand at the front and keep everything carefully under control and have kids sitting in rows behind desks and have people filling out worksheets and so on, and just started to realize how much what I do is controlled by my imagination. What do I think I'm doing when I'm teaching? What do I think is permissible? What do I think might lead to learning, as opposed to fulfilling the social roles of teacher and student? I had a classroom of kids who walked out with no idea that they'd been reading for 40 minutes. Etienne Wenger has got a book called Communities of Practice that's worth a read. Etienne Wenger, Communities of Practice. He says, two stonecutters are asked what they're doing. One responds, I'm cutting this stone in a perfectly square shape. The other responds, I'm building a cathedral. Both answers are correct and meaningful, but they reflect different relations to the world. The difference between these answers does not imply that one is a better stonecutter than the other as far as holding the chisel is concerned. There isn't a Christian way to hold the chalk. But it does suggest that their experiences of what they are doing and their sense of self in doing it are rather different. The difference is a function of imagination. As a result, they may be learning very different things from the same activity. Two stonecutters doing exactly the same thing with the hammer and chisel. One's creating a cube, the other's building a cathedral. They're learning different things by doing the same thing. What do my students think they're doing by by being in my classroom. Since Reading Gamer, I've been asking myself this more and more often. When my students walk into my classroom and sit down, and I start doing things with them, what do they think is happening? What do they imagine this is all about? What do they imagine a language classroom is for? Why do they think we're doing what we're doing right now? And I've started trying to take more responsibility for that. How do I start nudging their imaginations in particular directions? How do I deal with the mismatches? If what's in my imagination and what's in theirs is very different, we're going to get friction. If I think we're involved in a passionate pursuit of truth, and they think they're fulfilling a core requirement without their grade suffering too much, there's going to be a little friction. Or the other way around. A colleague told me a story about his daughter, who was still angry about something that happened in her final year of her Christian secondary school. She'd been asked in a religion class to prepare a sermon. And it was a long project. They had to go research it in scripture, read commentaries, read at least one secondary text about it, prepare the sermon, think about the structure of the sermon, illustrations, and then they had to actually deliver the sermon in class for the other students, and then they received it back with a grade. She was still angry several months later. She said, I chose a topic that mattered to me. I wanted to know what the truth was about this topic. And even after all the study, I wasn't quite sure if I'd nailed it, if I really had hold of what God would want to have said about this topic. And so I was really looking forward to presenting this sermon and maybe getting some feedback and maybe learning whether I'd hit on something. And what I got back was a letter grade and some comments on how good the writing was. It wasn't what I wanted. If my student thinks they're engaged in a passionate pursuit of truth, and I think I'm getting the grading done, there's going to be friction. Imagination circulates in our classrooms. What do I think I'm doing? What do my students think I'm doing? How do we start to bring those into harmony with each other? How do we start pulling in the same direction? What do I think I'm doing as a language teacher? Why is foreign languages in the curriculum? If a student or a parent says to me, why do we have to learn German? Especially in an English-speaking environment where we think we don't need other languages because we have all the power already. What do I say? Do I say, it'll help you get a better job? Appeal to self-interest. Well, that would fit with the rest of my teaching. After all, most of my curriculum's appealing to self-interest on a regular basis. So I'd be pretty consistent. Let's keep the story going. Do I say, because you have to? It's a requirement. Do you know what I've heard in schools around where I am? I've actually been in a meeting for parents where a guidance counsellor said to the parents, I really recommend that you get in 4 years of foreign language in high school because it will save you from having to do any in college. Because that's the way it works in the US. If you get your foreign language done in high school, you don't have to do it at university. You have to do some later if you don't. Like, the reason you're learning this is to get out of learning it later. It's a really interesting reason for learning. Well, some of you who were in the workshops yesterday know what my answer to this is. It's that we ought to read Leviticus. Leviticus 19 verse 18. I know you read Leviticus 19 regularly. I hope you will from now on. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against one of your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. This verse is kind of important. Jesus said it was part of that on which hangs the law and the prophets. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus wasn't improvising. He was quoting Leviticus. A few verses later, in the same chapter, it says, the alien living with you must be treated as one of your native born. Love him as yourself, for you were aliens in Egypt. There are two places in the Old Testament, both of them in Leviticus 19, where it says, love someone as yourself. The first one says, love your neighbor as yourself. You've heard that 1,000 times. The second one says, love the foreigner as yourself. You've probably heard that rarely, because you probably go to white English-speaking churches. The alien, foreigner, immigrant, stranger, the person who is not from your community, who doesn't think like you, doesn't speak like you. Treat them like one of your native born. Love them as yourself. How do you love someone as yourself? Well, there's another place where Jesus formulated this slightly differently when he said, on this hang the law and the prophets. Do you remember the other formulation? Do to others like you have them do to you. What does the evidence suggest that most white English speakers would like the rest of the world to do for them? You want them to learn English. You want them to learn enough about your culture that they don't misinterpret your behaviours and impute bad motives to you. You want them to understand your politics. You want them to serve you your food even when you stay in hotels in their country. Maybe that's just a British character flaw. Was Jesus kidding? Was this one of those little private religious truths that applies to the way you behave on Sundays? Or might this have something to do with the way we treat other cultures, other language groups? Our assumption that we're the center. I say this to my students, do you want to spend the rest of your life living out of an ethic that says if anybody else in the world has anything important to say, they'd better spend 6 years studying so that they can say it the way that I can hear it? Or are you willing to go halfway? Are you willing to start putting yourself in a position where you might be able to hear other people say important things to you that are said in another language? We talk all the time about learning to speak another language. We rarely learn to talk about learning to hear another language. Why? I tried an experiment in my church. I went around a lot of people who I thought knew scripture really well. I said, do you remember the sheep and the goats? Sheep on the left, goats on the right. Eternal bliss, eternal judgment. Do you remember what the sheep did and the goats didn't do that made the difference? Everybody remembered feeding the hungry, the thirsty, visiting the sick, clothing the naked. Almost everyone remembered visiting people in prison, which was really strange because we didn't visit people in prison in my church. So it would have been far more convenient to forget that one. Not a single person in my church remembered the one in the middle of the list. And you know, when some of us forget something, it's old age. When we all forget something, it's ideology. If I was hungry and you gave me something to eat, I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink, I was a stranger and you invited me in, I needed clothes and you clothed me, I was sick and you looked after me, I was in prison and you came to visit me, I was a stranger, foreigner, alien, immigrant, you invited me in, you welcomed me, you showed me hospitality. It's one of the differences between sheep and goats in Matthew. We can go on. To really make this stick, I would need to show you a lot of other passages. I don't have time. So I'm just going to preach to you briefly and move on. I don't run across this quotation in a book about the Reformation. And it was one of those paragraphs that lodged and stuck with me and has lived on my shoulders since. It says, put Zwingli, Swiss reformer, as for Augustine, sin was no more than self-love. Sin consisted in valuing oneself over others and conceiving of others and of God in terms of one's own self. It was to measure others in reference to oneself, to enter into social relations out of self-interest. Worship was the counteraction of self-love. The worship of God was the movement of the soul from self-love, self-orientation, to God and outward to others, honoring them, according humanity, equal value to oneself. And according God, greater value than oneself. This stuck with me. The first sentence that hit me was entering into social relations out of self-interest. That was what I was teaching students to do. Just make sure that you know enough German that you can make them give you a nice hotel room. Make sure you know enough German that you don't get given the wrong change when you buy a hot dog. I was teaching them to enter into relations out of self-interest. What my curriculum wasn't designed to do was to teach my students to honor Germans, to accord them equal value to themselves, to decenter, to start seeing foreigners as neighbors. I actually think that one of the things, if we were consistent with our own tradition, this is another story in the history of this, if we were consistent with our own tradition, one of the places in which Christian schools would be distinctive is that we would be far more heavily invested in language and culture learning than secular schools, who have less reasons to do it. This is what's in my imagination after 20 years of trying to think about this. This is what I want my language teaching to be about. Loving neighbours, loving foreigners, in a nutshell. How do I start to make that imagination operative in my classroom? How do I start to make this something that seeps into my teaching? And how do I start to bring my students to the place where they might think, this is what we're doing? I say to my college students at the start of the year, I say, if I say to you that foreign language teaching is about learning to love neighbours, And then we spend all year doing grammar exercises about how Hetzinger has cashed his cheque and Cordis has driven his car too fast. And reading soap stories about Sophie going to the pub in the evening. You should go try to get a refund. Because if you go down to a big store in town and you spend $5,000 on something, and it's not inside the box, what it says outside the box, you go try to get a refund. And then you should probably try to get me fired, because clearly I'm incompetent. So what are we going to do instead? Well, this is where we need to start looking at these other two processes. Choosing engagement. What we meant by this on the website is, how do I get the students to engage with this? Right? It's not just about me broadcasting ideas. I'm not just going to stand in class now and say, love your neighbor. It's not very effective. How do I engage the students with this? Are we going to talk about it together? Are we going to do group work? Are we going to do simulations? Are we going to act stuff out? How am I going to engage students? How are students going to get involved in this way of imagining the world? That's what we meant by choosing engagement. And then reshaping practice, I'm going to treat both of these together. That's all about, how do I take all of these physical details of my teaching environment and use them to serve where we're going? How do I arrange the chairs? Which pictures do I choose? Which questions do I ask? Which story do I tell? Where do I stand? What posture do I choose? What tone of voice do I use? How do I pace things? All of those are the tools at my disposal that I can use to start building a teaching and learning environment that engages students in a way that leads to the kind of imagination that I'm trying to get to. So this is the process I've got in mind. So I come back to this basic idea, hospitality. Hospitality to strangers is what I really want to be the core of what I'm about here. But I want to start breaking this down. What does hospitality look like, not just as an idea, but as a practice? And if I want my teaching to be shaped like hospitality, then where do I start bending it? Well, it seems to me that if I want my teaching, my language teaching, to be about hospitality, I'm going to focus on persons. In other words, the fact that mailboxes in Germany are yellow is an interesting cultural fact, but it's not as important to me as German people are. Somehow I want a curriculum in which German human beings come through in their humanness. They're not just these two-dimensional consumer ciphers who go shopping every weekend. So I'm going to need some way that persons come alive in my curriculum. One of the ways it's going to happen is through stories, through the kind of stories that Mark's been sharing with us. I'm going to need to teach attentiveness, because part of hospitality, if you invite me to your house this evening, and you feed me the best meal imaginable, and sit and studiously ignore me and watch television for the duration, this is not hospitality. A big part of hospitality is attentiveness, listening to each other, taking in what each other is saying. So I need to teach my students attentiveness, especially given that my students, most of the rest of their cultural experience is teaching them inattentiveness and distraction. So I need to teach them to slow down, to pay attention, to really listen. We need to tell stories. This is a theme. Hospitality doesn't happen until we've shared a story or two around the table. Right? Even talking about the weather will only go so far with British people. So I need to bring more stories into my classroom. I don't want my language curriculum just to be little dialogues where we get into hotel rooms. I need stories. I need there to be an element in my classroom of learning from, not just learning about. This is very important to me. At the end of a year in my German classroom, I don't want my students just to be able to say they learned some things about Germany. I want them to be able to say they learned some things from Germans. That's different. I want every student in my class over the course of a year to have had the experience of having a German say something to them that changes their life. Because I think it's hard to stay prejudiced when that happens. And finally, I've still got this question, how do I foster my students' imagination? How do I get them to see languages in a different way? And getting young English-speaking American students to invest in language learning is pretty much as hard as I gather it is here. English speakers, we speak the dominant world language. We can just be complacent and rest on that. So how do I go about doing this? Well, here's one example. I can't show you my whole curriculum. Here's one thing that I do regularly. I come to class one day and this photo is on the screen. And I let it sit there for a minute or so before I start. And then I ask a question, which is usually the first thing to do. The question is simply, what do you see? Well, start answering that for yourself. This group's maybe a little large for us to go through this together as a class, but that's semi-simulated. What do you see? Somebody tell me what you see. Imagine you only know a little bit of German and you're not going to get all sophisticated on me. You're talking real basic words here. You're in your second year of German. What can you see? People. The rest of it was way too sophisticated. People. Thank you. People. Yeah. Soldiers. Good. Yeah, slow down. You've got way too much language here. Right? You've only second year German. You've just got a few words. Right? Yeah. People. Soldiers. How many people? Three? I'm hearing four, five. Fünf? Six? I've got six at the back. Six? Let's count together. We've got one here, we've got a shoulder and an ear, number two, number three, number four, number five, and either he has two left arms, or else there's a sixth person there. Six. Now, pause, step out of the room for a minute. What have I done already in the first 3 minutes of this class? First, I got sick and tired of teaching about cartoon people. My textbooks are full of cartoon people. You can't feel empathy for a cartoon person. There may be some exceptions. Some cartoons do rise to the status of art. But not many of the ones in school textbooks do. You know, Tom and Jerry, you can beat up cartoon people and you don't feel empathy, right? If I want empathy for foreigners in my classroom, cartoon people is not the way to go. I need real people. So I've chosen a photograph of real people who've got a real story. That's my first choice. The second choice that I've made in my questioning is to choose a picture that has some ambiguity in it. So this conversation always goes the same way. You're not unusual. Somebody shouts out people, somebody else says three people. And I go, three people? What am I doing here? I'm saying, slow down. Pay attention. Your first impression is going to be wrong. You're slow down, give this time. Look carefully. There's more. Again, that's part of what I'm teaching. I didn't stand at the front of the class and preach, be attentive. I built it into my pedagogy. If I do this regularly, doing it once is not going to do a whole lot. If I'm doing this regularly, it's going to gradually teach my students that they've got to slow down, they've got to linger. We're trying to interpret people here and you can't get that all at once. So I keep asking questions. I say, six people. Are they all soldiers? No. How many are soldiers? Two, maybe three, a little unclear. How many are male? At least four, maybe five, yeah. How old are they? 20s? 18, 19, 20, 21, somewhere around there. Yeah, how old is the photo? Old, yeah. Way before I was born. 1940s. Where are they? In Europe? Where specifically? What kind of environment? They're in a park. Looks like a park, some trees. It's like maybe a roadway behind them, a fence. What are they doing? Talking? Listening? He's writing. The guy on the right has got a pen and a paper, hasn't he? He's writing something down. What might he be writing? A phone number. Could be. Any other possibilities? Why might he be... Let's suppose he's writing a phone number. Why might he be writing a phone number? Yeah, maybe he wants to date her. Are there any other possible reasons? Separation coming? It's Germany, it's the 1940s. Any other possible reasons? Maybe it's a security check. We start spinning possibilities. How are they feeling? Worried. Give me some more words for how they're feeling. Serious. Nervous. Sad. Now, pause. Step out of role. Just observing yourself, what's happened to your relationship to the people in this picture in the last 3 minutes? Are you more concerned about them now than you were 3 minutes ago? Do you feel more of a personal connection with them? Do you want to know what happened to them? You feel a little bit of emotional pull towards being concerned about the situation? How did I get there? How did I in 3 minutes get you from never having seen these people before to having human concern for them? Well, I did it mainly through, partly through the choice of picture, and partly through the sequence of questions, which was carefully structured so that I started with external details. I start with how many people, where are they, how old are they, what are they wearing? I didn't ask that one this time, but this takes longer in class. I start with external appearance, then I gradually move to what they're doing, so we start getting a sense of situation, and then I move to what they're feeling, what's going on inside them, and then we might talk about why they're feeling that way and so on. This happens every time in class, it's like magic. By the end of this, by doing this for 10 minutes, my students want to know what happened to these students, to these people in this picture. I start revealing more information. What do you know now? They could be brother and sister, they could be married, but two of them share the same name. Now, I'm going to have to speed up here. In class, this takes me 40 minutes. But I start revealing more of the story, little bit by little bit, more pictures, more details. We find out from this picture, well, what do we know now? Well, if you've got real good eyesight from the back, you know that they both died in 1943, and that they were in their early 20s when they died. Why might they have died in their early 20s in 1943? We find out that the third person in the picture was Christoph, was a married student at Munich University, had a couple of young children, liked to go hiking at the weekends up in the hills in Bavaria. And here he is with his wife on a weekend hike. We find out that these were all medical students at Munich University in 1943, and that they started a student group and called it the White Rose. And the purpose of the student group was to resist the Nazi government. And they started this group because they read in the book of James that you should be doers of the word and not hearers only. And they decided that they couldn't consistently just be against Hitler and not do something. So they started writing leaflets and distributing them around town, leaving them on park benches and public telephones, bulletin boards, mailing them to random addresses. Some of them were smuggled out of Germany, and the British made millions of copies, like this one here, and dropped them from planes over Germany. After 18 months of doing this, and I'm cutting the story short here for time, one day they were leaving piles of leaflets outside the lecture halls at the university before people came out of the lectures, and the janitor saw them, and he arrested them. In the next 5 days, they were interrogated extensively. They were put on a public show trial on the fifth day, and then within a few hours of the trial, were beheaded. There are three films about them. The most recent came out a few years ago and is really worth seeing. It's on DVD. It's called Sophie Scholl, The Final Days. A profoundly Christian film made by an atheist director. It's a really interesting movie. And in some ways, that's a good thing because it doesn't have any of that kind of kitschy Christian propaganda feel that you sometimes get in Christian movies. Now, what's this story doing for me? It's showing my students that there are Germans who don't just go shopping. It's showing my students that there are big ethical issues in life that they're going to have to deal with. I gave my students a questionnaire after first teaching this. So what have you learned from this unit? And they wrote things like, normally they write stuff like, I've learned words for food. I've learned the present tense. Well, some of them wrote, I've learned that not all Germans were Nazis. They thought that was a useful outcome. But several of them wrote, I've learned that I need to stand up for what I believe in. I thought, isn't that an interesting self-reported learning outcome from 2 weeks of German learning? I've learned that I need to stand up for what I believe in. How did we get there? By telling a story. Of course, this is still going to work as German learning for me. What we're doing here is we're learning the past tense. We're telling past tense stories. We learn vocabulary through this, notices of vocabulary for clothing, numbers, ages, how many people, where are we, parts. Like, all of this is basic language learning vocabulary. It works for me as pedagogy. But at the same time, I'm telling a story that's drawing my students in and making them ask big questions about who they are and the choices that they're going to make. And if I do this regularly, if this becomes the pattern of what I do, then maybe I can tell my students that language class is all about learning to love foreigners, and they shouldn't try to get a refund or try to get me fired. But maybe that's actually what we're doing. We're gradually slowing down and opening up to hearing Germans tell us stories, the challenges, that ask us to change. A couple of quick examples from other curriculum areas just to close, because I focused on language learning. What I've been trying to do though is, I know you're not all language teachers, I'm trying to illustrate the process, right? How do I start from wrestling with what is it that I imagine I'm doing as a geography teacher, a history teacher, a language teacher, as a Christian? And then how do I start turning that into ways of engaging students by choosing and using the practice details of my classroom, choosing the picture, the story, the question, the process? If I want empathy, then I need a teaching process that leads to empathy. I can't just tell my students to love people. I used to be a skeptic at my college, I still am a little bit. I'd often see course proposals where people have to put a Christian perspective paragraph in for science courses. And the Christian bit would say, students will experience awe and wonder at the complexity of God's creation. And I would go, no they won't. I've sat through lots of science courses where I didn't experience any awe and wonder at the complexity of God's creation. I experienced mostly tedium, competitiveness, failure, angst, and a variety of other things not deeply related to awe and wonder. Most of the textbooks that I saw in science classes weren't calculated to inspire awe and wonder. So again, I want to go, if you're going to claim this, then show me the engagement, show me the practice, show me the pedagogical process that might lead to this, and then you can say, I'm teaching students to experience wonder at God's creation. So then I was, standing, changing in the changing rooms at Calvin with a colleague at our sports facility, and he starts telling me what he does in his chemistry classes, which is come to class at the start of class and have the lecture theatre darken. This is for a university level chemistry course. And for the first 5 minutes, show large, high-resolution photographs of different snowflakes in silence. And then embark on his chemistry lecture about crystal structures and the stuff that goes with that. If that's what he's doing, he can claim to me that he's doing awe and wonder at the complexity of God's creation in his science class. Right? I'm persuaded now, because he can show me a repertoire that might lead to awe and wonder. Or does this photo belong in a math class? What do students think math is about? Is it just for calculating your mortgage? Figuring out how much you might earn if you work for 17 hours at $14 an hour? What's the range of realities that come into a math classroom? Well, some colleagues of mine, and if you're a math teacher, look up this address, you'll find some more stuff there. Some colleagues of mine worked on a teaching unit that's all about the tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004 that caused great devastation along the coast of Thailand. And the first part of the unit is about the math of wave formation. How do you describe the shape of a wave? How do you describe the motion of a wave? If you can describe that mathematically, can you predict it? Can you predict where the wave's going to go and how big it's going to be? If you can, does that mean it's somebody's fault that all of those people died in Thailand in 2004? Because we should have been able to predict it, but we did not accurately know. So you see how quickly math is connected with suffering, with responsibility, with ethical questions. The second part of the unit is about the mathematics of aid. You've got a helicopter. You want to drop food and blankets to as many people as possible before it gets dark. The higher you drop them from, the quicker you can move on to the next place. But there's going to be a height above which you destroy the contents of the crate. How would you figure that out? You've got a limited amount of helicopter fuel. You want to get through as many people as possible before dark. The coastline is a strange shape. How do you figure out the quickest path between these points? One of the things we use math for in the real world is to help people, to alleviate suffering, to try to respond to natural disasters, to grapple with our questions of responsibility for our environment. Is that reflected in our textbooks? Is that part of what students learn math is for in school? If not, why not? Okay, what story is being told? And how does it turn into teaching? Go to the website. There's 100 examples there. I've just given you three. There's 100 examples there from across the curriculum. And people trying to connect their faith to their teacher. You'll like some of them, you won't like some of them. I don't care. Go let them spark your imagination. Spend time with each other. Make time as teachers to talk to each other without complaining about your students and your pay. And just spark each other's imaginations about pedagogy. Use CEM, use CEPA, use NICE. You've got a lot of resources here that people in other parts of the world don't have. You're getting together and studying and talking to each other about how to teach Christianly. Nobody else is going to do this for you. You are the future of Christian education in this place. Figure out how to teach Christianly. It might take you till you retire. It's okay. You've got time. Work on it. Thank you for listening.